Hi, all. My name is Jennifer Huddleston Kelly, and I am an alcoholic. I've been kept sober since December 5th of 92, and that's my miracle. And the Legacy Group in Plano, Texas, is my home group, and it's an honor and a privilege to get to be here. There's a lot of me up here right now. I'm hoping that changes pretty quick. I am so excited to be here. I've been stalking y'all for 2 years. And because God loves me, I got invited to come. But I have a lot of friends and heroes and people that I just love in this room. And I care what every single one of you thinks. Every single one. And I'm not allowed to lie to change what you think about me. And so all I can do is just say a prayer and share my experience, strength, and hope with steps 4 and 5. I'm going to start out with a little public service announcement. And I don't know why I feel compelled to do this, but I feel compelled to do this. I am your weeping speaker. I know very little about what's going to happen this morning, except I can almost guarantee you I will weep. I want to show you I have tissues. I found them in the parking lot of the Asian grocery store. And you'll note there are plenty of them in here because I don't actually use them because I got stuff to say. But when I weep, what I have noticed is some of you can just kind of roll with it. And then there are the tissue bearers. And I love you. I love you. And I know that your compulsion to help me when my voice begins to quiver, I can see you. You're at the ready, you know, and you're looking. You're looking for the tissues because you gotta help. And y'all, I talked at an Al-Anon conference in Georgia, and good Lord, they covered me in tissues. Because they had the double curse, they're Southern and they're Al-Anon. And I say that because it's funny, but here's the PSA about it. When people weep in a meeting, something's broken open. And I don't know if God's coming out or God's coming in. Sometimes it's both. But for me, when that happens and somebody comes up to help me, I become self-conscious again. And it breaks that moment. And whether it's your intention or not, what I feel is, you need to straighten up and pull it together. And so, this is not just for today. I think it's, you know, wherever we go, because somebody pointed it out to me. You know, let that moment happen. Let it happen. After it's over, sure, pass the tissue. But until then, let's just let whatever happens, happens. Because this has to be a safe place for us to feel. So on to our favorite steps 4 and 5. I love it because it starts out with vigorous action and strenuous effort. Two of my favorite things. I believe in the stories of Alcoholics Anonymous. They are what began to heal me. And they are what I connect to, and so that is the way that I share. I'm certainly going to share some things from the book because it's my experience, but mostly I'm going to share my story with this. I did not go to treatment. I did not go to detox. I didn't go to rehab. I went to AA. I got a felony DWI because I'm an overachiever. And I didn't know there was a place for somebody to go who didn't have money and didn't have insurance, so I just went to AA. And I didn't go quick. I orbited you, and I drank one more time, and I orbited you, and I reached a place of desperation on December 4th of 1992. And I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous. That's where my recovery began, and that's where I get my recovery today. And I got a sponsor, and I didn't get a sponsor because I really thought I needed one. I got a sponsor because you bullied me into it. I fell in love with you almost immediately. I knew from almost my first meeting that you were my people. And because I loved you and did not want to leave you, not because I knew I was an alcoholic or was looking for a way of life, but because I fell in love with you, I let you peer pressure me into stuff, you know?
Get a sponsor. Come to the women's meeting.
And I still, like, still, when there is this much estrogen around, I go, oh, God, we need to break this up a little bit. So I got a sponsor, and I didn't know what I was looking for in a sponsor, and it really didn't matter. She had multiple years of sobriety. She went to a lot of meetings, and she called me precious, and that's really all I needed to know. And we began to work the steps-ish. And when I say that, I don't believe that she had worked the steps out of the book. I don't believe anybody ever showed her how. And mind you, I'm new and I'm crazy. So this is what I remember about it. This is my perception of what happened. You know, she gave me some writing assignments to do on steps one and step two. We did the third step prayer out of the book, and then she sent me home and said, the four steps in the book, you need to start that. Okie doke. And I don't know why. This little diagram on page 65 is kryptonite to newcomers. Baffling! And so I read pages 64 and 65, and based on that information, and that information only, I wrote a fourth step. Now, for those of you who don't know, the four step starts on page 64 and goes to 71. Oops! And I didn't know that. I really didn't know that. And so I wrote a lot of three columns. I didn't write a fourth column. I didn't write about fear, and I didn't write about sex. When I got done with about 137 pages worth of resentments, because I'm a collector, I told my sponsor I was done. I went to her house and I shared what I had written. And to my knowledge, she didn't point out that it was incomplete. And she told me I had done a good job. She hugged me, and we burned that inventory in a coffee can on her patio. And what I now know is we can't transmit something we haven't got. Nobody had ever shown her how to do a complete inventory. And it was being passed on down through the line of sponsorship. Because once I did the steps out of the book, I went back and sponsored women I got sober with who had the same sponsor or grand sponsor or whatever. And none of them had written on fear or sex. So they hadn't been shown either. And as a consequence of not doing a complete inventory, maybe, I don't know, it might have happened the exact same way if I had. But my story is, over a period of time, I'm sitting in meetings and I'm still twitching. And I think I've done more steps than I've actually done. And when people talk about the fourth and fifth step and they talk about the release and the freedom and all those things, I didn't experience that at all. But I get a year chip and I go dating. And by dating, I mean I went on one sober date And I went out with this guy that I met at my home group, and he had a sponsor, and he went to meetings, and I had a sponsor, and I went to meetings, and the date is going well because he's flirting with me. And but I don't know about my fears, and I don't know about my sex inventory. And halfway through the date, he says he's getting a little uncomfortable because there's drinking in the place where we are. And he asks if it would be okay if we went to his house and watched a movie. And y'all, I swear on a big book, I did not think anything of that. I swear to you, I did not think anything of that. Because I'd been going to other people's houses watching movies sober. I had. And nothing ever happened. And he had a sponsor and I had a sponsor. We went to the home group and I knew he was sober. And so I went to his house. And we began to watch a movie, and things got hot and heavy, and he became very aggressive, and I didn't want that. And I got up and I grabbed my purse and I said, I'm not comfortable with this. I gotta go. And he said something really charming and romantic, like, no, I don't do that. And I sat down, and and within a few minutes, we wound up back in that same spot, and I grabbed my purse, and I said, I'm serious. I'm not comfortable with this. This is going too quickly, and this is not what I want. And he said, I'm sorry. It won't happen again. And I sat back down. And I didn't have an opportunity to leave the third time until he was finished with what he had set out to do. And I know what my experience was. What my experience was is that there could be no confusion about consent. But I don't know what his experience is. What my inventory has taught me is that I don't know what you thought, what you felt, what your perception was of an experience. I know for me that I struggled, that I cried, and my clothes got torn in this process. So in my mind, there was no confusion about consent. But I also know that I had two opportunities to leave and I didn't. And he may have read that a very different way. And so I hesitate to diagnose what his motives were, but I know what my experience was. And what my experience was that I have guilt and I have shame, and it is exactly like a situation I had found myself in drunk. And I had not acted or reacted any differently than I did when I was drunk. When I was drunk and this happened, I went to my best friend and I told her what had occurred. It was a mutual friend that this had happened with. And her reaction was, well, what did you think was going to happen? Why did you go to his apartment if that's not what you wanted to happen? And it was much easier for me to take full responsibility for what occurred than to take a look at my powerlessness and my fear, and that I had been forced to do something that I would have done willingly. And so I'm back in that spot, and I'm stark raving sober, and I don't want to tell anybody. The good news is I can't keep a secret. I'm in pain. Not about me. I can keep yours. But I'm in a lot of pain, and I don't want to tell my sponsor because my sponsor has just admitted to me that she hasn't worked all the steps and that I need a new sponsor. And the person that I told was a trusted friend. It happened to be a man, but he was a solid man in Alcoholics Anonymous. And the reason that I told a man was because I wanted him to handle it. I wanted him to beat that guy up or kick him out of AA, one or the other. Because he was still sitting in the meetings across from me. And I'm not sure I'm going to stay sober. And, and instead this man said, you have got to find a woman to talk to and you need to do that quickly because I don't want you to drink over this. And so I found a sponsor that worked the steps out of the book, and it was very different than my first experience. And I will say that I will be forever grateful to that man because He brought me to my knees in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I began to work the steps like my life depended on it, because at that moment, I was clear that it did. And I don't think I had that attitude before that. It felt sort of like the steps are what you do while you're hanging out here with your friends, you know. It really did. And I'm a real alcoholic, but I just didn't take it seriously until I was really afraid I was going to drink. And so the sponsor who took me through the book launched me on a course of vigorous action. We said the third step prayer, and she said, stay here. And she walked out, and she had a notebook and a pen and a ruler in her hand. My official four-step notebook, my official four-step pen, and the official four-step ruler that I was allowed to borrow but not take home. And so I began to do a by-the-book inventory. And Bill uses some kind of scary language about this inventory. He talks about it being, these resentments being infinitely grave and fatal. We're shut off from the sunlight. We drink and die. It's poison. It has the power to kill. I mean, he's using some language that's got me a little afraid. But for those of you who are new and that inventory seems just looming, I have an analogy. It's super goofy, but it works for me. So here's my perception of and my experience with the inventory. Let's just say I'm a person who really, really likes to eat cereal. Like, I love cereal. I've been eating cereal all my life, but I got this little quirk. I like to save the boxes. And when I'm a little kid, the boxes that I save are those little boxes, those little cute boxes. And my parents go, she's a funny kid. And so they get me a little cereal box chest. And I just put my little cereal boxes in that chest. Weird kid, but okay. So they let me keep my cereal boxes. And that's no big deal, except that I get bigger. And the cereal box situation gets a little more out of hand. And so now I have a cereal box closet, and that's okay. I mean, we're doing pretty good with the cereal box closet until that gets full. And then I have to have cereal box shelves, and then I'm shoving the cereal boxes under the bed, and I'm storing them in the oven. And the next thing you know, they're all over the kitchen table, and the cereal boxes are getting a teeny bit out of control. And then I get sober in AA, and I'm talking to my sponsor, and I sort of slip up and mention that I missed work on Tuesday because I had to deal with the cereal box avalanche. And my sponsor says, wait a minute, do you keep cereal boxes? And I go, well, yeah, I do. And she goes, that is crazy. I used to keep cereal boxes myself. Really? And she says, how many cereal boxes you got? And I'm like, a few. And before I can really go into it, she begins to tell me about her cereal box situation. And she says, you know, the cereal box has kind of got out of control with me. And because I had so many, you know, my friends started being all judgy about the cereal box. My mother was always coming over trying to organize the cereal boxes. When you got that many cereal boxes, you got to be kind of careful on who you invite over, because, you know, a nice guy opens up your apartment door, sees all those cereal boxes, and goes, nah, I'm good, you know? So the cereal boxes kind of start deciding who I can hang with and who I can sleep with and whether I'm going to make it to work or not. And I'm like, yeah, we're there. That is how I'm living it. And she says, the cereal boxes are causing you some problems. And if you're ready, I think I could help you figure out a way to get rid of them. Well, I mean, they're my boxes. And she says, yeah, but I did some research, and in my experience, what I learned is these cereal boxes have no value at all. Really? And she says, here's my experience. My sponsor came over, and the first thing we did was we sorted out the boxes. We just sorted them into piles, three piles. Turns out I only like three kinds of cereal. Here's where my story gets dumber. So we start piling up these cereal boxes, and I got Resentment Crispy boxes. I got Frady Flakes. Wait for it. And I got Getting Lucky Charms. Which is a misnomer because it's not really that lucky and there's nothing charming about it. And so first we sort them out into piles, and then my sponsor says, you know, we really can get rid of them. But you know about the prizes, right? What prizes? Every box has a prize in it. Shut up. No, really, there's a life lesson in every box. What? And we begin to dig through these boxes, and we pull out the prizes, and we get rid of the boxes. And I get to move forward with these new life lessons so that I can act and react differently than I had before. Goofy, but it works. So what the fourth step says in the big book is being convinced that self was what had defeated us. And I always pause when I read that. Because I don't know that when I begin the inventory that I am convinced that I am what has defeated me. I'm pretty sure you are what has defeated me and continues to defeat me and often thwarts me in my quest for happiness. But in this process, I become convinced that perhaps I have a role in this. You know, and through the process of 4 and 5, I do become convinced, but I don't think I start the process convinced. So, and this is where we get into those four columns. We get into those four columns looking at resentment. And the first column is simply that I label it. I put the name or the institution or the principle that I'm mad at. And I'm going to be honest, my first 12 inventories, I probably didn't have a principal or an institution. We just wrote down people I hated. Or who hurt my feelings. There's a lot of that. Because I got two speeds. I got Raggedy Ann and Sabretooth Tiger. And there's not a lot in between. In the second column, we write the cause. And for me, it's pretty important to say that what I write in the cause is my story. It's my story. And my story has usually been revised more than once. It starts with, and this is really one of the things from an inventory, it starts with, well, she invited her to Starbucks, she didn't invite me to Starbucks, and I hurt my feelings. It starts there, and then I start tweaking it a little. And each time I tell it, the motives become more clear in her actions. And y'all, by the time I get done with this, every time I think about it, I cry. Or I'm mad. And I mean, this happens so naturally. I've been doing this since I was a kid. This stuff becomes obsessive. I gotta turn off the car radio to retell that story. And I gotta add in, and the next time I see that hooker, let me tell you what I'm gonna say. And mind you, this starts with, I didn't get invited to Starbucks. So in that second column, I'm writing my story, and it's my story heavily edited. In that third column, I'm going to write down what areas of my life this affects. And here's my aha that I had this week, really taking a look at this step. What I'm writing in that third column are the instincts that Bill talks about in the 12 and 12. I mean, that's just like a coconut fell out of a tree and hit me in the head yesterday. What do you know? There it is. That's how that meshes together. For those of you who haven't had the coconut, I'll explain. What Bill talks about is that we have instincts, and they're completely normal. What the big book talks about is self-esteem, security, ambition, personal relations, sex relations, and pocketbook. And he says, you know, these things are completely normal. It's okay to want to have good feelings about myself and to feel like I'm a good and worthy person. It's okay to want safety and belonging. It's okay to have aspirations and goals. It's okay to want to feel connected to other people, both out in the community and in the world, within a family, at our workplace, and intimately. In a sexual way, completely normal. To want to be able to support ourselves and to live in the world comfortably, totally normal. But we take it a smidge further. We turn that stuff up to 15. And the instincts go awry. And then we get to that fourth column. And I'm just going to share one of my peeves. I got it from my sponsor. Not my current sponsor, but old sponsor. Anyway, one of my peeves is people who sit in the meeting and go, I have to look for my part. Here's my problem with my part, and this may just be me. I mean, I got several problems with my parts, but here's my problem with that idea. When I say my part, I'm hanging on to ratios. And what we have discovered is I am a scorekeeper, and if I'm keeping score, I'm losing. And so when I say my part, I immediately think, you have 85% of that pie, and I have this tiny little 15% sliver. And I'm hanging on to that victim role, and I'm setting myself up. I have no humility, I am not teachable, and I'm already setting myself up to talk myself out of owing an amend. So what my book says is, setting aside what anybody else did, I look at my mistakes and where was I to blame. And for me, that's not just semantics, that's a really important part. And that's why I do the first three columns, all of them, and then I go back and I switch gears and I look only at myself and my actions. And what I begin to discover is, I got this sliding scale of morality. Like, I worked for this boss who, you know, he used to roll in, he's an attorney, he'd roll in once the sun got warm, and I was supposed to be there like in the morning answering the phones, and slowly but surely I notice I'm rolling in a teeny bit later every day, and suddenly my hours change from whatever they were, 8:30 to whenever. And they turn into 15 minutes before he gets here. Now, my time card says that I roll in at 8:30. But the reality is I'm showing up 15 minutes before he gets there. And I start seeing this kind of behavior all over the place. Suddenly, I get to change how I react to life. I mean, I know the difference in right and wrong. But if I think you're more wronger than me, then I only have to be a teeny bit better to feel superior. And so as I'm writing that fourth column, what I begin to see all on my own is how these instincts have gone way too far. And here's another big aha. When I look at my instincts going too far, I can pair them up with the seven deadly sins that are discussed in the 12 and 12. So when my self-esteem goes too far, I get pride. And my pride says, I can't admit I'm wrong. I'm not going to admit I'm wrong. I'm not going to ask a question. I'm not going to ask for help. I have got to get this together and fix it all on my own. When my security becomes threatened, I take it too far and it turns to anger because I'm feeling threatened. I don't belong. You're taking something that's mine. And I begin to live in that fight or flight. When my ambitions go too far, I indulge in gluttony or sloth, which means I want more than my share, but I don't really want to do much to get it. When my personal relations go too far, when my desire for personal relations go too far, I start living in envy and that scorekeeping starts taking over my life. When my sex relations go too far, my instincts for sex go too far, I begin to live in that darkness of lust. When my desire for financial security goes too far, I am living in greed and I become ruthless in what I will do to get material things. That's yucky. Like you turn that rock and there's a bunch of squiggly stuff rolling around. And when I finish writing that that inventory, there are a few things that I observe. This instinct becomes an obsession. The obsession becomes a demand. And unhappiness follows. As a matter of fact, what Bill says in the 12 and 12 is I become ambushed into alcoholism and misery. And so what I discovered when I'm writing this down by myself, I had this aha. There was a moment when I didn't want to write that inventory. I was right in the middle of it, and I couldn't figure out why new Jennifer had to write about what old Jennifer did, because I was reborn in step three. I mean, you can use that book to your benefit. And what happened was somebody took me into his confidence. He told me something that he was embarrassed and ashamed about. And I was really flattered that he trusted me and that he talked to me about it. We were hanging out in between meetings. It was a few days, maybe a week later. We were cutting up like we do in the midst of him, of us just kind of teasing each other. He said something that I considered below the belt. And I took that secret and I threw it right back in his face in a room full of people. Yeah. And that man left that meeting, left the group crying. He was humiliated, and I didn't know if he was going to drink. And I knew that I didn't premeditate that. I didn't plan it. I didn't know I was going to say it until it was flying out my mouth. But I had used that thing that he had entrusted me with, that treasure that he had given me, and I had used it as a weapon. And I used to think I did that stuff because I drank. And in that moment, I realized I drink because I do that stuff. That's how I treat people. And that's how I treated people before I ever took a drink. But it's sure how I treated people after I took a drink. And it is still how I will treat people under the lash of alcoholism. And so when I look at the fourth step in the big book, one of the things that hit me that struck me this time was that the idea from the ABCs is all over this fourth step. I can't, he can, I think I'll let him. You know, that is represented in the resentment section, it's represented in the fear section, it's represented in the sex section. First, I got to get to the place of humility where I know I can't do better than this on my own. I can't. I will hurt you automatically without thinking. Being unkind sometimes is as natural as breathing air for me. Because I feel threatened and that just happens. But then I realize that there has to be a better way, and I begin to figure out how to invite God in and how to respond differently. I continue to do inventories because untreated alcoholism in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous will take me right back to the same pain and shame that alcohol did. It has done it over and over and over again. And I don't even realize it. It will happen while I'm sitting in the rooms. My greed will get the better of me. My sex behavior will start being fraught with secrets. I'll get, you know, a little resentment. You know, the little kind that suddenly turns into a Tyrannosaurus resentment, and I feel justified and I've dressed it up in principle. Y'all do that? Man, I got costumes for this stuff now. And so I get done with this inventory and I run to a sponsor. I know people who have done it where they write the inventory and carry it around for 4 months. Good Lord. That's like emptying the litter box and then putting the bag of dirty kitty litter in your car. Let's bake that in the sun for a couple of weeks. Delicious. I often tell my sponsor I am done with an inventory before I am, so that I will get it done. And I will tell you that the lady who taught me how to do an inventory did something very elegant. She broke it into bite-sized pieces. I meant to share this earlier. I'm going to share it now because it's important. She gave me the assignment to do the grudge list, and that's all she gave me. When I got done with that, I went to her house, and she gave me a page out of her inventory with 4 columns on it. It was straight out of her inventory. She didn't tell me how to do it. She showed me how to do it. You know how you get an A in AA? You copy your sponsor's paper. And she gave me a paper. She gave me a copy of something out of her inventory. And I studied it like it was a CIA document. And she said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm memorizing it." And she said, "Why?" And I said, "So I can give it back to you." And she said, "Why?" And I said, "Because it's private. I don't want anybody to see this. What if somebody saw it?" She said, "I don't care. What if I Xeroxed it? And I put it on the windshield of all the cars at your home group?" She said, "I don't care." I could tell that who she was writing about was somebody she done slept with. I said, "What if I give this to your fiancé?" She said, "I don't care." I could not believe it, y'all. I knew she was wackadoo because this first sponsor burned it, you know. I had heard all kinds of stories about this stuff. Like, I figured you had to make arrangements for if you died, somebody had to sneak in your house and get all your porn and your inventories and get it out of there. Or your personal pleasure devices, whatever. You do you, boo. And this lady didn't just tell me I could be free. She showed me that I could be free. Because she gave me a page out of her inventory. And I finished the sex inventory. I went to her house and she showed me how to write the fear inventory. She had me do it in 2 columns. One was, what is the fear? And the second is, how has self-reliance failed me? And I wrote about what I do in reaction to the fear. And for me, that was very useful. What I discovered is that when I am afraid, I act in a certain way. When I'm afraid I'm going to be abandoned, I test people. You got to test them. You got to find out if they're ride or die, especially guys. You need to know if they're a runner. So I like to do little pop quizzes. I call it, "Do you love me now?" And so you just ask, repeat, "Do you love me now? Do you love me now? Do you love me when I do this? How about this? 3 o'clock in the morning. How about now? You love me now?" Then you do something weird and hormonal and you burst into tears and start screaming at me, "You love me now!" And you just keep doing that repeatedly. Let me tell you, I have 100% success rate with this test. Because literally every man I have performed this test on has proven himself unworthy. May sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. But eventually, if you test them hard enough, they will go, "No, no, I do not. I am out. I do not know what you need, but I am 100% certain I do not have it. And I say that like it's funny, but it's how I lived my life. It's how I lived my life for 40 years. And I got sober at 26. I start looking at that second side of what I do in reaction to fear, and what I discover is I'm afraid about being broke, and sometimes I react to that by blowing money. It doesn't make sense to anybody but the alcoholic. I'm afraid of being abandoned, so I hide. Alcoholics love that. You ever hidden from alcoholics? They forget you're gone. Because they're either thinking about themselves or so busy being of service, they don't even notice. You show back up, I'm back. They're like, you were missing? And what I discovered just writing this out, I didn't need a sponsor to show me, and writing this out in two columns, what I discovered was I would take an imaginary fear and I would make it real. And I would take a fear based in reality and I would make it worse every single time. My book says, we think there's a better way. You think? Except this is revolutionary. We trust infinite God rather than our finite selves. We recognize the fear, we acknowledge it, we ask God to remove it and to direct our attention to what He would have us be. Not what He would have us do, what He would have us be. When I identify what He would have me be, a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, a kind wife, a good sister, a responsible daughter, the tasks sort of fill in the blanks themselves. And so So that's my fear, and then in my sex inventory, I take a look at my behavior. And y'all, I thought of the sex inventory as the whorometer. I found that humiliating. I really thought this was sort of AA hazing. And I tell it like it's funny, but you know, this was the part I can't write this down. There's no way I can look at this. I don't even want to know the number, much less anything else. Only it's a real simple process. It's eight little boxes with some questions, six little boxes with questions in it. Who? Stumper. Where was I selfish, dishonest, and inconsiderate? Whom did we harm? That was a surprise because I really only thought there were two options. And come to find out, my selfishness and self-centeredness in this area affects a lot of different people, especially sober. The next is, did I arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? I'm not really big on jealousy or suspicion, but I make up for it in bitterness. And that's kind of my strong suit. And I identify what that looks like for me. And it says, what should I have done instead? And for those of you who haven't done the inventory, I'm going to let you copy. I got two answers that go in that box. It's either slow down, because alcoholics like to do relationships at the speed of microwaves. We move them in and then figure out their marital status and their last name. The second possibility is run like the wind, because we see stuff right in the beginning and we ignore it. We blow right past it because it doesn't match the story we're telling ourselves. We gotta hurry before we find out this is a bad idea. Which sounds crazy when you say it out loud, but I got over 100 pages of I gotta hurry before I find out this was a bad idea. And then I've gotta share this with somebody. So I sit down and when I went to do that inventory with the sponsor who took me through the book, I had that big fat secret. And I knew I'd sat in a ton of meetings. I had a year and a month, and I'd sat in meeting after meeting after meeting, and I'd heard about people who keep their secret and they drink. And some of them don't make it back. I know that's not a good idea. So I played chicken with God. He always wins, by the way. the way that I did that was the night before I did my fifth step, I went to the Denny's recovery unit with my friends. And we had this game we liked to play at the Denny's recovery unit. We called it the honesty game. Because honesty was so new to us, we made it into a game. And the honesty game was real simple. Somebody asked a question, and everybody went around the table and answered it honestly. It was kind of crazy. It had a lot to do with who do you want to sleep with. But sometimes we got into some real stuff. And the night before my fifth step, I went to play the honesty game, and I had made a deal with God in the parking lot that if anybody shared something that was similar to my big fat secret, I would share it with my sponsor. But if nobody shared it, then it was mine to keep. Because my secret, I mean, I know y'all all had them, but mine was like super weird. Super weird. Like if anybody found out, we were going to have to write new pamphlets. Weird. So we go around the table and everybody's sharing their big fat secret. And y'all, it's just lame. I mean, it involves funky sex behavior and gunplay. Theft and infidelity. I mean, just the regular stuff. But I don't hear anything that sounds like my thing. And so I've got my big fat secret. I show up at my sponsor's house and the first thing that she does is she asks a question, and I do this with the ladies I sponsor, although now they've heard it and they know the answer. But what she asked me was, why do we do a fifth step? And bless my heart, I want an A in AA. But when I don't know the answer, the Jeopardy music plays in my brain. And so she says, why do we do a fifth step? And I'm like, so we can find our character defects and serve God and our fellows. And the sunlight of the Spirit and the three legacies. And I just start rambling every AA thing I can think about, hoping that I will see some glint in her eye and know when I'm warm. And she cuts me off. She whips out her little big book and she reads, which is what she does. It's how she became my sponsor, when she read the book at me. And it says the best reason first, we might not overcome drinking. Oh yeah, the drinking thing. You know, it's so right here, I can't remember it. And y'all, it's still why I do this step today. I mean, I like the byproducts, don't get me wrong, but I am absolutely certain that I am capable of taking another drink. You will never hear me say, I can't drink again. I have spent too much time skating on grace. And I don't know where the ice gets thin. So it says we pocket our pride and we go to it. And my sponsor, before we began, said, I'd like to say a prayer. And I thought, oh, God. So she begins to pray. And y'all, I don't know exactly what she said, but I know what it sounded like. God, please help Jennifer be honest. Because if she is not honest, she will drink and And it seemed like a really long prayer, and it seemed to involve a slow and painful death or honesty. And then she said, go, you know, and I began to read, and I read the first piece of my inventory, and she talked a little bit about herself, and I talked a little bit about myself. She said I did a good job, and we turned the page. I get to the second page, nothing happened. I don't burst into flame, nothing. I'm holding on to this secret. Nothing's happened. Ha. I read that second page of the inventory. She tells me a little bit about herself. She asks me a question or two. I tell her a little bit about myself. And she says, good job. And I turn the page. I get to the third page of my inventory, which is about this guy who neglected to 13th step me. True story. He tried to 13th step everybody, and I promise you I was not the bottom of the barrel at my home group. And I was offended that he didn't try and 13th step me. And I finish reading that part of my inventory. My sponsor asks one question, and I fold like a cheap lawn chair. My secret comes flying out of my mouth, and I can't even believe it. No bright lights, no bamboo shoots. I just, bleh. And I'm going to tell you because I know it's killing you to know. The question was, are you straight? And the answer was, I don't know! I was listening to Bob D. talk on this last week, and he said, usually the big secret is somebody touched me inappropriately or I touched somebody inappropriately, and I'm going to add to that, or I don't know who I want to touch inappropriately. There are some exceptions, but usually that's the theme of the big secret. And I'm also going to share this because I've heard a lot of fifth steps and a lot of times, especially when it's a woman and the secret is I touch someone inappropriately, it is often child on child. And I'm just going to say this because I think it's important. Molestation is assault. It's a violation from someone who understands what they are doing. They have the hormones and they have a motive and they're doing it in secret. When a child is curious, they are incapable of molestation. And what we do is assign adult responsibility to a child's action. So if that's your secret, stop it! That's not fair, and it's not accurate, and it's not right. And I know that because I looked up the definition for molestation. You can't have done it if you're a kid. You can't. And by the way, who's walking around remembering stuff that happened when they were three? I remember one thing. I remember the day my sister was born, and I was really mad about it. That's it. So, you know, if that's the thing, be free. And if it's the other two things, then share it with your sponsor. And if you need outside help, go get it. I've been in counseling two times, and it was because my sponsor and I reviewed some things from my inventory, and she said, we need to bring someone else into this process. And it wasn't a substitute for the inventory and the Sane and Sound Sex Ideal. It was an addition to, and it helped me immensely. But I took everything that I got from therapy back to my sponsor, and we created a game plan from that information. Don't be afraid. She taught me how to be a patient and how to talk about the things that I needed help with, and it served me very well, because sometimes, especially when we're talking to somebody who may not have that exact experience, there are resources available, and we can bring that back, and it's helpful. So I share my big secret, and I just want to tell a couple of stories from, I don't have a lot of time, but, one of the big ahas was I shared some things about my mom. You know, there were big ahas in all my family, in all my family stuff that I shared with a sponsor, but the one that I remember so vividly was writing about my mother. And my mother was not an emotional lady. She was not particularly emotionally demonstrative or available. She didn't really know how to respond when I got emotional. She still doesn't. Like, I start to cry and she writes checks. She does not know. She doesn't exactly know what to do with that. And so in my inventory, I wrote about, you know, the kind of mom I wanted and the kind of mom I felt like I needed. And I knew that she had done the best she could with what she had, but that doesn't change the fact that my experience was I didn't feel connected to my mom in a way that I really wanted to. And y'all, I'm crying because it's completely different now, and I'm so grateful. But So I'm sitting there with my sponsor, and she says, "Tell me a little bit about how your mom was raised. Tell me about your grandmother." And I said, "Well, she was a broom rider. She was a very hard woman. She really, even my mother will tell you that. She was a very difficult woman. She was a very angry woman, and she was a very controlling woman." And my sponsor said, "That's really interesting. Do you know anything about how your grandmother was raised?" And I said, "I don't know much." And she said, "You might try and find out. Ask your mom what she knows." And as we began to discuss the way that my mother was raised and who she was raised by and the situations and circumstances that were going on in her home growing up, what my sponsor said was, "Wonder who would teach her how to be a warm and fuzzy, huggy mom." And y'all, that resentment was sucked out of me immediately. Like it was gone. It was gone. The big book talks about, when it talks about a spiritual experience or a spiritual awakening, it often uses the word revolutionize. I'm a big fan of looking stuff up in the dictionary. And I found that there are two definitions for revolution. One is a turn, like a revolving door. And that's what occurred as I shared this. I began to look at something from a different angle, and it was completely different. Suddenly, I realized I'd been trick-or-treating for Snickers, and my mom didn't have any Snickers. She wasn't withholding them from me. She didn't have any. And as soon as I could accept she doesn't have any Snickers, suddenly I discovered she got Reese's and Rolos and all kinds of stuff. Like I could see these amazing gifts that my mother had given me. My mother was an amazing mom. She is generous to a fault. She taught me. One of the things that I wrote was that she never told me I was pretty. When I asked her if I was pretty, she was an English teacher, and so she would quote my town, our town, and she would say, "You have strong features. All my children have strong features." And that kind of, I don't know why that sizzled a little bit when she would say it. But today I know that what she taught me was that I had so much more value than just how I look. That there are so many things that are important and valuable and worthwhile about me, more than just the package I am wrapped in. She showed me that, and I love it. But I couldn't see that when all I was focused on was what she wasn't. So I saw something different. Now, the other definition for revolution is the overthrowing of a government. And those are the ones that take a little longer. Because the overthrowing of the government is up here. And the government lies. The government lies. It tells me things that are absolutely untrue. The government tells me that other women are a threat to me, and when they show up in my circle, I gotta make sure that I'm on top and that she gets squished out, or else there won't be enough love for me. And I do it at work, and I do it in the family, and I do it at home, and I do it in the community. I take that old idea and I treat other women as a threat, and I start living my life like AA is a competition. And I hate me some competitive AA. This is a spiritual place. But all of a sudden, I'm taking pride in something that saves my life. I'm doing it to save my life. And suddenly, it's become something real twisted. So I share these things, and we begin to start looking at my sex behavior. And y'all, the inventory is just to figure out what we don't know. That's all it is. It's just to figure out what we don't know. So my sponsor can help me invite God into this place and we can grow towards something different. And so I begin to look at my sex behavior and I begin to pray and invite God into this place. And I ask God to show me what kind of person he would have in my life. Because remember, I'm a little confused. And that's okay. You know, my sponsor told me to ask God what I was, and she said that if it was okay with me, God, and my sponsor, it was just okay. And I will tell you that I'm married to a man right now. Maybe you think you know the answer. Maybe you don't. but I don't have to explain or defend it because it's okay with me, God, and my sponsor. And I got free. And I began to change my sex conduct, and I also began to learn something from every relationship I was in. I began to find out a little bit more about what was important to me and what wasn't, and how I was changing, and how I needed to be different to learn how to be a true partner. Golly, I want to tell the story about swimming. Okay, so I got this fear. When I got sober, I could not swim. When I was a little girl, I was obsessed with going off the diving board. A family friend said he would catch me. And he didn't know that a little roly-poly girl in a bathing suit who's wet is kind of slick. And and so I jumped off the diving board. I went right through his hands, and I went to the bottom of the pool. Obviously, I did not die. But I got afraid, and I got real afraid of water that was over my head, and that fear stuck with me moving forward. And my parents knew that, and they put me in swimming lessons over and over and over again, and I was a star student right up until they tried to take the floaty thing away from me. And when they tried to take the floaty thing away from me, I was like, deuces, I'm out. I'll be on the side of the pool. I can't do this. And so I shared it. What the book says is we feel that fear ought to be classed with stealing. And I knew that my ability not to swim was stealing some quality from my life. And so I admitted to my sponsor that I didn't know how to swim. And she said, well, I guess we got to find out if God knows how to swim. And there's a little irony in this because I was a preschool teacher. And by my count, I've taught over 300 kids how to swim. I just didn't know how myself. There's a secret for you. And and so the summer after I did my first real fifth step, I took the kids to the pool for the daycare. And at the last 15 minutes, I practiced not drowning. I'm not really a swimmer, but I'm not a drowner anymore. So that's kind of cool. And I started out with, you know, learning how to tread water and saying the serenity prayer. And those lifeguards, they're 15 and they're twirling their whistle and they are not focused on a large woman in a skirted bathing suit. God, grant me the serenity. And I learned to go halfway across the pool and then I learned to go all the way across the pool. And once I could do that in 6 foot, I tried it in 12. And it turns out if it's over your head, it doesn't really matter. And by the end of the time, I could get all the way across the pool and back. And I never told anybody I was learning to swim that summer. I just did. And the last day that we were on the pool, this little kid that was in my class named Drewby. Beware of children named Drewby. They can talk you into anything. Miss Drewby said, hey, Drewby came up to me and he said, Miss Jennifer, when are you going off the diving board? And I said, Drewby, how about never? And he said, Miss Jennifer, if you don't go off the diving board today, when are you ever going off the diving board? And I thought, never still sounds good. And Drewby said, I got an idea. I'll sit on the side of the pool. Matthew will get in front of you. Adam will get behind you. And you can go off the diving board today. And for some reason, Drewby seemed like a messenger for God. And so I decided I had to find out if God could dive. The pool that we were at had three diving boards, a low dive, a high dive, and an Olympic diving platform. And you know where those kids went? Straight for the platform. I was like, nah, 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 nah. God's big, but he ain't that big. And he really is, but I still don't. And so we're standing in line for the little diving board, and Drewby's over there doing this, and Adam's in front of me, and Jason's behind me, or whatever, and it's finally my turn to go off the diving board, and I jumped in, and I came up for air, and I took the deepest breath I'd ever taken. It was like being reborn. Then I found out God knows how to dive, too, and I got on the van with all the kids, and Drewby said, I got an announcement to make. And he said, Miss Jennifer went off the diving board today and she looked like a big old frog.
And it made me laugh. And later on I learned that FROG stands for Fully Rely on God. And I've told this story for a really long time because it's my fear story. But there's more to it. My husband and I, we don't have a pool, but we go to the community pool because I do not have a body image at the community pool. Like at our community pool, there's red and yellow, black and white, every size, shape, color. There's burkas in the pool. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff. And it's not about me anyway. And mostly we sort of put our Kindles in baggies and read books in the pool. So one day we're at the pool and it's getting really hot because we're in Texas and I smelled bacon. And so we went to jump in the pool. And my husband's kind of panting and we're talking and he said, Jennifer, what are you doing? And I said, what are you talking about? He said, are you kicking your legs? And I said, no. He said, are you moving your arms? And I said, no. And he said, how are you staying up? Turns out I'm freakishly buoyant. Now, here's the truth. It's fat. Fat floats. But. It works better as an analogy for fear. When I was afraid, I drew that fear near me, and every time I went in the pool, I went to the bottom of the pool because that's what I believed would happen. When I began to trust and rely on God, I discovered that I was held up in a way that I could not understand or explain. That God would absolutely provide everything that I needed if I would just take the leap. And he has over and over and over again. And I begin to believe that after I get done with this fifth step. I've done a bunch of fifth steps because I wasn't willing to do the tenth step. And that leads to a lot of inventories. And I get the same results every time. I get the same results. There are three results that I can identify that I get every single time that I share a fifth step. The first is that I recognize that I am neither as wonderful nor as terrible as I think I am. I think that's a glimpse of humility, perhaps. The second thing that happens is that we have sorted into piles what's my job and what's God's job. And a lot of times I've been trying to do God's job and I have not been doing my job. And the third thing that it happens every single time I let somebody in on my secrets is I believe wholeheartedly that everything's just going to be okay. I don't know how. I don't know what that's going to entail. But I do know that God's going to take care of me if I just keep moving forward. So I think I'll keep doing it. I'm glad to be here, and it's a good day to be here.
Before we pray, I just want to say something real fast. Alcoholism is the only disease I know that can make someone feel alone.